Welcome, everyone. This is Mia Ferraletto, publisher of New Observations magazine, welcoming you to our show today and introducing our guest, Dr. Lisa Paul Streitfeld. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, you said my name right, which is great. It's great to be here. It's great to have this conversation with you.
Great to have you here. Lisa is a very experienced writer, art critic, and artist, performance artist predominantly, author of two books, Hermeneutics of New Modernism and Kundalini's Daughter, and had her own Kundalini Awakening in 1983, which is almost 40 years ago. Amazing. Her father was a pioneer in Kundalini research, and Lisa contributed an article to issue number 133 of New Observations magazine on reality. And when I heard the title of her book, Kundalini's Daughter, I knew that she must have a connection to an old friend of mine, Lee Sinella. And it turns out that Lee and Lisa's dad were partners in their Kundalini research. So how about that synchronicity?
I couldn't believe it when you first contacted me, you mentioned him, and I'm thinking, how would you know? Because I don't think there's anything out there, or maybe only Lee's book, but I haven't checked recently, that mentions that they were actually partners in the Kundalini Clinic in San Francisco. I stayed there when I was in college in the 1970s, and that's where they were really working with people with Kundalini emergencies. So, I mean, I was sort of immersed in the destructive aspect of the Kundalini before I had it. I guess it was, you know, maybe 6 years later. It was actually at my father's funeral, over his coffin, pretty much, that I was awakened. And this is a very interesting story because it was this woman, he was working with this group of Raja Yoga. Do you know Raja Yoga?
Tell us about it.
Okay, Raja Yoga is the highest form of yoga. It's really strict. It's very strict about what you can eat. It's a total, like, environment. He wouldn't, like, eat anywhere where the energy wants it right. So it really is the strictest form of yoga. It's a lifestyle. And my father, who is Jewish, had this problem with women his whole life. I don't know about women, but with his mother, the Jewish mother syndrome. And so his story is very mythical, that he was a leader in the human potential movement in the 60s. He was a Neo-Reichian. So that was this era of, opening up. There's a very good documentary about this. It's called The Century of the Self. And that is really, and now there, and somebody just sent me today, it was very synchronistic, that there's a book out called The Breakthrough, that these were the psychologists of the breakthrough. So my father was in this wave where he started the East Coast East Coast Esalen, basically. We went out to Esalen when I was a child, where he did some workshops, and then he came back east and started his own growth center. So he was proud of saying that he was, every new movement, every new therapy that came through, he was on top of it. He would, experiment with it and create workshops at this growth center that he had. So I was, like, taken to encounter groups when I was just, like, 10 years old. And he was really actually the first pop psychologist, where he was, like, on Mike Douglas' show and these talk shows demonstrating encounter groups, which really shows what kind of era it was. Such an exciting time in the early 60s. So his story is that he experimented with everything that was the Western, and then he It didn't solve his problem. So when the gurus started coming through the doorway in the 70s, he was the first in line in San Francisco with his friend Stan Grof. He wrote about this, and they for Muktananda. So then my father's a Scorpio. He didn't do anything halfway. So he just got really like he gave up everything. I mean, he left the family, everything behind, and just entered the ashram there. He had an ashram in Oakland. And then he got, I don't know if he got disillusioned with Muktananda. I mean, they worked closely together, and that's where he really learned a lot about the Kundalini. Muktananda was probably the most informed about the Kundalini, along with Yogi Bhajan, who I met later when I had my Kundalini awakening. So he was like supposedly writing a book. Muktananda wanted him to write his biography, but that never panned out. And I don't know how it happened, but he ended up leaving the ashram. And then he was about to, he was at a conference where he was going to like bring forth this knowledge that he had about the Kundalini. And I think he never delivered it. All of a sudden he met this group of women, a group of Raja Yoga women. This was some kind of world spirituality conference in India. And these are women that just channeled directly from the creator. There was no male guru involved. And he just like thought these women were the ultimate. So that was his mythical story. From like having such a problem with his mother, he ended up saying, the only way we're going to have peace in the world is if women rule. And these women were just so powerful. So there was a woman there at the funeral. Her name was Sister Denise. Before, I've never met anybody with such spiritual power. She just seemed to not even walk on. She seemed to walk on air, you know. And so she cupped her hands over my forehead at the funeral, and to comfort me because I was really weeping. And that's it. I mean, you know, I didn't really connect that that was the beginning. That's what she did, is open me up in that way. And but then it was like way many years later, 2008, after I put out this book, 2009, and I had this blog connected to this book, Kundalini's Daughter. And Bill Broad of the New York Times, the chief science writer of the New York Times, contacted me and wanted to chat about my father's work. He was writing a book called The Science of Yoga, and I told him about Sister Denise, and he was investigating the Kundalini, who was the pioneers doing the work in the Kundalini, and he tracked her down and said she opened a lot of people in that way. I mean, it's called Shakpat. Shakpat? I don't know if I say that right. Where, like, the guru does that. I mean, that's
the transfer of energy. The transfer of enlightenment.
Yeah, exactly. So that's like what you do. You line up with the guru, and then, but see, this is also where it's very dangerous if you're not prepared for it. And I was working as a reporter in Mexico City, and, you know, I went back after the funeral. I remember I got very sick, and then I went back, and then I couldn't live in Mexico City anymore. I was so sensitized, you know, and I was writing a report on pollution control equipment, and I was taken on top of the U.S. Embassy where they had the pollution control monitoring. It was actually a secret. They didn't want the Mexicans to know this. And so I actually had these secret reports of what was in the air in Mexico City. And then I was just like, oh my God, you know, I mean, all of a sudden I was just so sensitized and I couldn't live there anymore. So that was sort of the end of my career as a reporter because, well, that's another story. But, well, also another part of the story is that my father was saving to go to India, so he left about $5,000. So I have four brothers and sisters, so we each got $1,000. And they were, I think it might have been Sister Denise saying to me, inviting me to go to India at this conference in his place. But, you know, I just didn't want to go that route. I guess that was my rebellion, you know. And instead of going like that route of going to India and becoming part of these communities, I spent my money going to Argentina. It was just this feeling I had, this instinct of needing to go down, you know, needing to go into the underworld. And Argentina was like that. I mean, it's the end of the world, you know. I actually ended up going down to Tierra del Fuego, the really end of the world. But but it was, you know, the year that they were actually just broken free from the dictatorship, and they had like 1,000% inflation. So it was just chaos. So that's what I did, is I made arrangements to go work as a reporter there, but it was just so hard to set myself up there. It was just so crazy. So that's when I wrote my novel. My first novel, you know, was set there, and that's where I wrote it, which was, I didn't think of it at the time, but now I could say, well, that was about my Kundalini awakening and dealing with my father's death, you know. But, you know, I came back to New York and I thought, oh, I'll sell this novel. It was a time of all this young novelists all my age. Bright Lights, Big City changed the whole kind of publishing world. But nobody was interested, you know. I mean, it was just, you know, I don't know why. It's just taken so long to get this kind of story of women's awakening through their collective. You know?
Well, your father and Lee were very much a part of a whole group of amazing people in the 1960s who were ushering in, I hate to call it the New Age movement, but the science behind consciousness and spiritual awakening. Robert right. Monroe, the Eileen and Peter Cady with Findhorn. Lee has written a book about all of his friends, his circle of people that he knew, and it's extraordinary when you look at this group of pioneers, and of course his book on psychosis and Kundalini that he wrote in the 1960s is still considered to be a classic. You talk about Kundalini emergency events in people's lives, which that book is about, and did you experience some sort of an emergency, or was it a relatively peaceful transition for you?
No, it was 10 years of hell. I mean, in my life, would every 2 months something would change. You know, I know I'm ruled by Mars. Well, I got into astrology, and that really helped a lot, because once I
at the same time.
Well. In Argentina, I guess, I was really introduced to astrology because they live by it down there. You know, you have 1,000% inflation, you can't make any plans. And they were just, they're so into astrology. That's where it really started for me. Yeah, and I came back and there was this well-known astrologer, very fatalistic, you know, that I went to in Argentine. And he goes, oh my God, I don't know what to tell you about your chart. And so that was, you know, that's where it came from. And it's funny, right, that I had this kind of roundabout way instead of, like, why didn't I just look up Lee? But the thing is, I didn't know about Lee until, I would say, maybe even the early 90s. I discovered that book at a book convention in Southern California. At the same time, I met, actually, this writer called Anna Deo George, I think. She wrote a book called The Wheels of Life. It's just an extraordinary book on the chakras, incredible amount of information and knowledge. And she had an acknowledgement to my father in that book. And then, so that was this, and so it must have been the same day even that I find Lee's book, and he has my father's case history in that book. So it was really interesting to read my father's case history in this book, you know, written by his partner. But I didn't know about Lee. I don't think I knew about him before that. And
well, I just want to interject. Lee was a psychiatrist and ophthalmologist and Kundalini practitioner himself, truly a Kundalini master. And I met Lee because it turns out he was the uncle of my realtor when I bought my house in upstate New York. And we happened to be in his nephew's barn, and there was Lee's book on Kundalini lying there. And I said, oh, Kundalini. And Eric said, "Do you know about Kundalini?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "My uncle wrote that book. You can have it." And I wrote to Lee as soon as I read it, and we began corresponding, and that was the beginning of our friendship.
And when was that about?
What year? 1998.
Yeah,
I had been working with my Kundalini at that point for more than 20 years.
Yeah, isn't it interesting when you know, we're both Aquarius, so it's hard for me to distinguish what is just being Aquarian and being so open from actual Kundalini. But I would say, you know, as an astrologer, I can really see these things and, you know, in terms of patterns. I realize now it was in 1984 that it really hit me when you asked, was it smooth, you know, like what kind of experience was it? That's when Pluto went into Scorpio. And that was, and then of course, I do always have this instinct of sort of going to an environment to work out the internal dynamic. So that's where I was, 1984 in Argentina, when Pluto entered Scorpio. I remember, you know, I gotten very involved with like the social elite there. And I remember a dinner party, and there was a man with this, really his skin was very pigmented, and he was dying of AIDS, you know. I mean, that was like the beginning, right? So Pluto and Scorpio represented AIDS. That was the same timing. And so that, you know, so that's when it was this, you know, it was just ferocious energy. And this is always the issue for, especially for women, right, is to control the energy, to channel it. And, you know, that it was, for me, it was writing, always writing. But I also then became very psychic. And where before I might have been intuitive, you know, I moved to L.A. and I really did start taking classes in you know, psychic, sort of learning how to harness it, you see. That would be the difference, right? I mean, how did that happen for you in the, like, terms of, you know, learning to channel the energy and not be so destabilized by it, right?
Well, in my case, I was really born this way, and it wasn't until I was 30 years old that I understood that everybody wasn't like this. So my awakening, so to speak, really had more to do with the people around me. When I was 19 years old, I was tested at Columbia University for right, left brain hemisphere activity, and at the time I was told that out of anyone they tested, my brain was the most balanced, and I process things simultaneously on both sides of my brain. So at the same time that I'm analyzing from a, you know, logical point of view, I'm analyzing from an intuitive point of view, and it's been very helpful. So I'm extremely organized and grounded, but I'm also able to pick up everything around me as well.
Well, so if you were tested that young and then you're told that, see, that would make a big difference. I guess, you know, in my case, I guess it was sort of like the cobbler's kids have no shoes, that it seemed to be the only person who could have helped me, you know, was dead, my father. Although, you know, what happened in the end is I became very good friends with a Sikh woman in L.A., and she was a family friend of Yogi Bhajan. You know, her father was a philosopher, a good friend. So I met Yogi Bhajan and then really got involved in Kundalini. That was pretty early, like that was mid-'80s. And so that's where I was learning to channel it. But, yeah, I mean, see, that's the thing. If they would have more testing of these things, this is what Stan Grof always talks about, you know, so many people going into a psychotic state, you know, that is a Kundalini emergency. And if they just weren't given drugs or weren't hospital, you know, if they were just had an understanding that was what's going on, then they could really, you know, it's a shamanic experience, basically. But in Western medicine just treats it as, you know, hysteria or traditionally like the Freudian idea of the hysteric, you know, so you need, I mean, now it's just treated with drugs. I mean, this is interesting. Somebody just sent me today, a psychiatrist friend sent me synchronistically a new book about this breakthrough of psychology. I mentioned it earlier, I think. And it the subtitle has to do with the fact that, you know, this was the breakthrough of the 60s where all these musicians, you know, and all the drug experimentation, like my father, one of his patients, I remember, was a member of the Mothers of Invention. I don't think I ever found that out if it was Frank Zappa, but, you know, so this is, but at the same time, it was the deep state was, the CIA was, you know, involved in all this. And that's, of course, what's come out more recently is how the CIA was involved in all of this with the drugs, right? So I don't know if that has to do with the fact that, you know, I don't know. I mean, this, it needs more investigation. I need to read that book, actually, though, it was sent today, because that's the idea of what could have happened differently if, I mean, something happened where it sort of stopped, as far as I can see, from just investigating my father. He got involved with this group called Eureka, and that was an Andean mystic called Oscar Achazo. And that's before he went to California and got involved with Muktananda. But this was where he wanted to take us all out of school and just immerse us in this Eureka society. And that's where my mother just said, no, I mean, this is ridiculous. But Oscar, what my, like after working on this for my PhD, investigating consciousness in terms of how the feminine was repressed, really was my focus. You know, so the Kundalini is the feminine energy. So if the Kundalini was still not really being, it's not, I mean, in the culture, the word didn't hardly, in the Western culture, it was something imported from the East, but it once it ever used, I mean, Jung, of course, would have started in the early 20th century. But when I was in LA in the early 80s talking about my Kundalini awakening, everybody said to me, don't talk about that, it's dangerous, don't do it. And I'm going, it's already been done. I you know, I'm looking for some therapeutic approaches. So I don't know. I mean, this is like, it's all caught up to me with the repression of the feminine, you know. I don't think you can separate the two. So, and maybe that's why I had to go on this journey, you know, instead of like just being tested early and realizing that this was like something very unique. I mean, the only way I could really write about it as a reporter, I did start writing about the left brain, right brain balance. That's acceptable. I mean, we're talking too about 10, 15 years ago, right? And then I intentionally wanted to bring the Kundalini into the art world. That was before I published that book.
Well, the Kundalini is already in the art world. It's not,
yeah,
it's
this was 10 years ago. I mean, I'm not, you know.
No. The Kundalini has been in the art world forever.
Well, but the fringes, I mean, where? I mean, you know, it's more mainstream, you know.
Well, I am too. I mean, all of these artists, the abstract expressionists, they're all working with that energy. It's not like
all right.
It's not like it's something new. It's totally integrated, but they're
I know. Use the terminology of Kundalini. I mean, that's what I guess I'm talking about. Connecting it to, because I mean, I don't know. It's sort of, to me, the goddess is forbidden in the art. Well, if you're talking about the Kundalini, you're talking really about the goddess. But maybe that was, I mean, you know, I mean, my friend used to say it's the G word, you know, it's the forbidden G word. So, I mean, I know Carolee Sheenham was doing it, but she had a hard time with that, you know, I mean, So this is what I'm talking about. Of course, we're talking about two different things. The energy existed, but, you know, I traced that. I did that in my master's thesis. I traced it from Schopenhauer all the way up to my father. I mean, they all, with these men, you know, Schopenhauer was the philosopher of genius. So, well, come to find out, he was studying Hindu philosophy. And so then he comes up with the word will. He took it directly from Kundalini, you know? So,
the world is will and representation, absolutely.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
You know, the Russian constructivists were you talking about the Odic force in the 1800s. I mean, this is not...
Okay. But that's my point, that these men, always men, develop a new word. And we're talking about the goddess energy. But then
well,
the men embed the new word, and then they're called the genius. I mean, you can refute that, but I don't know. I've investigated. I mean, so like with Reich, it was the Oregon. You know, that his whole Oregon theory was basically Kundalini. And, you know, on and on.
Well, that's exactly the point I'm making. It's around.
Okay.
It's been around forever. And
All right. I'm not saying the energy's new. I'm talking about the fact that, you know, let's call it what it is. We're talking about the feminine divine, you know. I'm not saying men don't have access to it. But, you know, you're not allowed to use the word goddess in the art world like it's an unwritten rule, you know. Because men have been the ones that always determine the rules, right? So they can call, they're always going to be calling it something else. But this has all been the way, the plan, you know what I mean?
So, I do. Okay. And I also have to say, I mean, women have been, we as women have been our own worst enemies, although I have to say I don't feel that I fall into that category because I've been deeply defiant from the time I was in grammar school. But, you know, we have gone along with all of this, and ultimately, in my opinion, our goal is to be gender balanced and just, you know,
right.
Be a soul. I mean, the more evolved we become spiritually, psychologically, emotionally, the more we're in sync with ourselves and our divine purpose and, you know, don't get into this polarity and dichotomy and,
you know,
Democrat, Republican,
yeah.
Whatever. We're being manipulated by, you know, I believe we're being manipulated, yeah, by the patriarchy and you know, and not exclusively, but yes, definitely.
Yeah, but you can trace all this. Like Jung, I mean, you're talking about, you know, what I'm working with, the theory of the Eros Gamos, right? Like I've been bringing that into my art writing for 20 years now, and it hasn't been easy. I mean, you know, like to me, you and me, it's totally normal, right? Eros Gamos is the sacred marriage, heaven and earth. We're talking about, you know, left and right brain marriage, right? But why has it been so difficult? I mean, that's what I want to know. Like, we can sit here and say, well, of course, this is where we're headed. This is the Aquarian Age archetype. But it's been repressed. So what happened is
it's been complicit. We have been complicit, though. Women have gone along with this.
Well,
it hasn't been just, you know, patriarchy squashing us. I mean, women for social and economic reasons have been complicit in all of this.
But that's what I call patriarchy. You know, I mean, the whole women's movement, you know, let's become like men. To me, that's still patriarchy. So this is like the whole journey is you have to confront your inner patriarch, right?
Yeah, so, autonomy is a totally different space and place. You know, individual autonomy is something else again.
But I'm saying,
is what we're all aiming for, regardless of our gender. Do you know what I mean?
But then, so what's going on now with transgender? I thought, okay, I look at every new kind of wave and I go, okay, this would be one. So now it's transgender, but they don't believe these people. They're not talking about inner balance at all. And I've confronted them too. I mean, because it's all tied up. I mean, what's going on? So this is where you get into like what the sinister underpinnings of all this, right? Why is this transgender movement being supported by huge amounts of money, but nobody's speaking about the need for us all to become intergender, right? The balance of male and female. So this is what I'm talking about. Like, how did this, you know, how, yeah, it's, you know, I study with deconstructionists. That's my PhD, was at European Graduate School. So this was the deconstructionists, you know, Foucault and Derrida, their proteges, you know, were my teachers, you know. So this is what I did, you know, you just find those gaps and you go into them. And how did this happen? And I could say very, you know, very clearly what happened with Jung. And this is also not being discussed because now the Jungian societies have a lot of power. They have a lot of reach. You see Jungian women, they seem very together. Yes, it is with Jung. It's still about balance of inner and outer. But Jung is a prophet for the New Age. He was totally repressing the dark feminine. And I mean, in 2011, I went to the Venice Film Festival where the premiere of A Very Dangerous Method, Cronenberg's film. I mean, this was like the beginning of the unraveling of all that. His love affair with Sabina, she was a hugely successful case of a woman who was considered hysteric, and she went through a total transformation. She was having a kundalini, you know, it was kundalini. And she became the first psychotherapist. So, you know, but why was she so repressed? I mean, you know, there was a play about her in the, in the 90s in New York. It was amazing. It was such a revelation for me that this woman existed. I mean, and I can tell you now, because I did the research, the reason why she was repressed, well, first of all, she was Jung's partner in starting this a new, you know, when he broke with Freud, he had a total breakdown, but she was his guide in the unconscious. And they had an Eros Gamos, definitely, you know, they were in the Eros Gamos and developed a whole new school of psychology, the school of archetypal psychology. But I found this out through, you know, sources that his wife threatened to leave him if he didn't stop the affair. And his wife really had the money, you know. He had a very nice lifestyle for somebody who was doing cutting-edge work. And so he had to break off the relationship. But even after they broke off, she re-entered his life, and she encouraged him to do the Red Book. Well, do you think in any of these expositions of the Red Book, you know, that this comes into the equation? No. I mean, this is still not being talked about in the Jungian world, you know, that he...
Well, it's standard practice. Henry James took whole, you know, paragraphs from his sister, Alice, and made them his own without giving her credit for them. That, you know, Colette is another great case in point where her books were written under her husband's name, published under her husband's name, and he sold the rights to them without her knowledge even. So luckily she wrote many more, but you know, this is not new.
Tragedy. No, I know, but you know, Sabina
and these women, you know, went along with it is my point. You know, ultimately they rebelled, but these cases we've
I mean, the men
described.
Have the money. I mean, the men have the economic means. I could just, you know, like, I've written a lot more than I've published. I mean, that's really what my story is about. The men have the economic means to. Now, of course, everything's changed with the internet, you know, but we're talking, you know, I'm old enough that before the internet, it was very controlled. I mean, publishing is still really controlled. You know, I'm only four corporations control publishing. So, I mean, I still can't get my books published through, like, mainstream publishers. So, this is what we're talking about. It still exists. So you say, why are women complicit? Well, yeah, you're right. At this point, why are they still complicit?
They shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, I think they're not really even aware of the problem is what I think, you know. They really don't know. If you're not, if you didn't have a Kundalini experience, it's all just, you know, spiritual mumbo jumbo, I guess, right? I mean, I guess that's what it comes down to. So the goddess, they don't even know they're repressing the goddess, right? Because that's what they're, you know, they don't have that in their experience. I would say that that would be the reason.
Well, consciousness is on the move and on the rise, and a lot of people are spontaneously waking up in multiple forms. So a lot, you know, we're living in a very interesting time.
Well, this year especially, speaking from an astrological point of view, this is the year. This is the big transition year, the total, a real breakdown of the patriarchy. You know, one thing after another, you see it, you know, the Weinstein trial is really amazing. I mean, what's coming out with that?
Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, the royal family, this whole Meghan Markle thing. That's very, like, that's a huge thing because she was a yoga practitioner, you know, and then she goes into this, you know, I'm sure those castles are haunted. They're just full of kind of demons. And, you know, she seems like she's possessed. So we're talking, you know, these are issues, you know. I mean, the fear is opening up because, you know, you've talked about that in our previous conversation about the danger of possession. It's very real. I mean, I saw that in around the 90s in L.A. It just seems it is everywhere, this kind of vampirism, possession. Yeah, that was one. Yeah. So this is the danger of opening up if you don't have a really grounded life. You know, once you get possessed, that's really, you know, hard to, I mean, you need a real exorcist at that point, you know? So,
yeah, I agree. And the arts are, of course, part of the way that all of this is spreading, you know, through music and entertainment. It's wild arts, the dark side of it. It's, it's extraordinary to turn on the Super Bowl or the Olympics and you're basically watching an occult, you know, a dark occult ritual there.
That is, yeah, that's really extraordinary because I've been tracking this for so long as a reporter, as a writer. And I remember saying to a curator in the 90s, like, why aren't there more artists working with symbols? And I didn't understand it because, you know, when I was working with the occult, it's all these, you know, symbols, and that is empowering. And it's transpersonal, you know, symbols. She said, oh, because they're so dangerous, which was really astute of her. And then, like, before you know it, it's all over the in the entertainment world. And, of course, that's where this whole conspiracy theories of the Luciferian, Illuminati and all this, and the codes, you know, covering the eye and all this kind of stuff going on. I guess that's the point. I mean, you know, there was sort of a vacuum of highly conscious people, and this is what came into the vacuum. I guess that's how I can see it now. And when is it going to stop is the question. I don't know. I mean, it's I don't know, like with Marina Abramovich, I had an experience with her. You know, she had just come back to this, she came to the States to stay. We gave her an award at the Critics Association, and I met her in the coat room. I guess it was maybe around 2009. And I met her, no, that was like 2005. I met her in the coat room at the Japanese Society, and I was holding the coat. She says, I'm not the coat woman. I really felt, I loved her immediately. And so I was writing about the symbolism in her work. She was using the pentagram all the, you know, from the beginning. She told me how she almost died within the circle of the fire, and this doctor came in to pull her out of the pentagram. And so I was, you know, I loved that because I was looking for this kind of symbolism. Of course, the pentagram is totally related to Venus because Venus has this pentagram cycle, and that's what the Christians did, is made the pentagram associated with the devil. And of course, the devil is, that's Venus is the devil then, because it's associated with lust and attraction. And so she seemed to be reviving that symbol, but she didn't seem to know about the connection to Venus, because I did a few interviews with her. And then, you know, next thing I know, she's become this world famous artist. Everybody seems to know her name. And she's working, she's doing this one hand over the eye. I mean, I don't know, you know, like, are they aware of what they're doing when they do that? Or is she posing with that?
Well, I don't really think her work is about Venus. And you're telling me that she doesn't know about the connection to Venus is no surprise. I definitely think she's in the darker category of all of this.
Venus in the art world, you can't talk about Venus and the goddess in the art world. So she said,
she's talking about a lot of other things, Lisa. You know,
recently, don't forget, I'm talking about 15 years ago, you know. So it's been a while ago. I mean, I'm talking, you know, I haven't even really worked in the art world for 10 years now. I left the art world to work, write about film, because I forget why I left. because I saw what was happening, all the art fairs. It's all been, you know, bought out, essentially. The 1% now, like, controls the art world. I saw how that was all happening, and, you know, I said, you know. And so I left. I left the States. I haven't even lived in the States for 10 years. So a lot of what I'm talking about is not current. I mean, you can bring me up on what's current, because I haven't lived in the States for over a decade. But, I'm talking about back then. I mean, I remember going to see Spiral Jetty, Smithson exhibit at the, you know, wherever it was, the Whitney. And the woman's talking about the spiral jetty, a female curator. All she could come up with is North by Northwest, that film. I'm saying, like, this is the oldest symbol of the goddess, the spiral. And then I said it to my friend Peter. I said, God, why can't we even talk about that? He says, well, if you did that, it wouldn't happen, you know. I mean, you just weren't allowed to talk about it. So you can refute that all you want, but... I'm saying I was a reporter and I could see it. I mean, this was phenomenology I followed for a long time. But I don't know about the last 10 years. I mean, certainly I helped, did what I could to bring the goddess into the art world. I did the show called Black Madonna in 2009. Well, that was interesting because that was at the same time Bill Broad contacted me. I was putting up the show. And so the New York Times had moved, you know, to Times Square, 8th Avenue, and this show was right, like, two blocks away. But he never actually got to see the show. But I can't remember what happened. He was also writing about missile systems at the same time, which is interesting, right, that he had all this. He was a real yoga practitioner, Bill. So anyway... what happened is I got a mysterious sort of summons, a call to go to this gallery if I wanted to give a talk. And I gave a talk about the mythology of Obama's election. And I sort of put it into this whole archetypal sense, which really sort of felt like what all the publicity propaganda, whatever, surrounding Obama, you know, change, that he was like...
Hope and change.
Yeah, the new coming, you know, the second coming or something. And so I put all this together as a talk show. Well, it turns out the man that was sponsoring this was the direct descendant. He told me this as I was leaving. The direct descendant of the founder of the Knights Templar, who even knew this person existed. But he... he went goes by the name H.P. Garcia, but his name is Hugh Payens. So he has the same name as the founder. Only once in a generation to somebody gets the name. So here is the direct descendant of the founder of the Knights Templar. He knew he can talk about this with me because I showed in my talk that I knew about this kind of thing. Now, see, that so then it was then I said, wow, I found these amazing photographs of Madonna, you know, like it was in Mark Wiener's studio. I go to look at his painting and these amazing photographs are propped up against the wall. And I go, what, who is that? He goes, that's Madonna. And he took these pictures right when she was about to become famous. And talk about Kundalini, oh my God. And they were solar prints, and she was like doing spontaneous yoga poses. I don't think she really was doing yoga at that time, you know, early 80s, I don't know. But it felt like, you know, anyway, they're just saturated with Kundalini energy. And I go, I have to show these. I mean, he never printed them, never exhibited them. And so that's it. I told them, I told Hughes about these photographs, and we put the show on. And it was called Black Madonna. And it was like 23 artists, like Carol Lee Sheenham's famous photograph of the serpent on her body was in it. It was an incredible show, but I tell you, it was like he had this gallery. It was in this building under construction. There was always the scaffolding on 8th Avenue, and then you go in, and he made it into a Templar's cross. It was, you know, that was the structure of the gallery, and then it became like this whole kind of occult experience because it was so hard to get into that gallery, you know, like you had really. Even on opening night, you know, it was like these lines were outside and you had to go up this elevator. I mean, it was like unbelievable. So
sounds amazing.
It was amazing. And I guess I realized it was really an undercover thing. I didn't really want it to be undercover. I was thinking, oh, well, maybe Madonna will find out about these photographs and she'll sue us. We'll get some publicity. Well, we had the image for the show had this big X across it. And I made that into performance where he made this big red X over her image. And that's, you know, and I had, then everything was converging at that point because I had met this woman named Margaret Starbird in 1997. And she, her whole research was that she really believed that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. Well, not maybe so much Mary, but I could definitely see they had a, you know, Eros Gamos experience together. And so she was so dedicated to this research and we became friends. And then in like, what I think it was about 2004 was the Da Vinci Code. And he was inspired, the writer of that novel was just inspired by her research. So she was thrilled. I mean, you know, he made tons of money and she was still pretty well unknown, although she did get some good, I think she did a TV special from that. So that was becoming then more known that, you know, Jesus never intended this religion, Christianity, to be this repression, exiled effeminate, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then now I've traced that, and then my new work, something's being published by Switch on Paper, was the research I've just done in Cyprus. And that's where Paul went. Paul the Apostle, on his first mission outside of the Levant, he went to Cyprus. He was invited there by Barnabas. So this is where it all happened, where this repression of this old religion of the sacred marriage, you know, and the baptism came in, you know. So.
And the repression of the women who were leaders of the church at that time.
Exactly. Exactly. Paul was really the one.
Yeah.
He was very much of a misogynist. And that's how it happened. But, you know, I didn't know at the time I was doing that research because I was even writing for the New York Times at that point. Yeah, that's what happened. 2005, they put out a call. Does anybody read the Da Vinci Code? And I said, yes, yes, probably I was the only one who works for the Times that read it. And I interviewed this debunker of the Da Vinci Code, and I was like, and then it was being made into a movie by that point. So I even went up to where it was filmed at, I forget now, Rocklin, yeah. That's where they thought the Da Vinci, the Templar treasure was buried. And so that's where they had the last scene of the movie. So if you go there and you get a tour, they'll show you this circle above the crypt, where you go down in the crypt. That's where they pasted an image of this six-pointed star, the double triangle, which is the symbol of the Eros Gamos. There's absolutely no symbolism there. If there was, it's been gone, you know, for many years. And so they put their own symbolism. Isn't that funny?
But that that's really interesting.
Yeah, they brought it into the collective. I mean, this is how this idea of the Eros Gamos got into the collective. And so, yeah, you know, again, with the man, right? I mean, she would have loved to have been censured by the church, probably, Margaret Starber, but they just totally ignored her work. So then it becomes this popular work of this popular thriller, you know. So that's sort of how it all, I'm trying to tie it all together here. But it does all sort of work together, because that's the thing, that there was this Eros Gamos. That's the myth that comes. All right, now I can bring it to where we're at now. So that's the myth that comes up every 2,000 years at the start of a new age, right? A new astrological age, right? So that's what this is. What's going on now, or like in the last, well, in the 21st century, has been what was happening also before the Christian era. All these different kind of creeds fighting for dominance, you know, and this total breakdown, and all the Luciferianism coming in, and which then created, you know, the opposite with Christianity. But of course, Christianity places Satan outside, right? As opposed to them. I've been studying now Mithra. There's an incredible Iranian-American philosopher who's just like gotten a lot of attention. Jason Reza Jorjani, who's written this amazing book about Iranian Leviathan, he calls it. And that's about Mithra, and also about, so that's the idea. Mithra is, you know, the androgynous male-female integration of opposites. But it was Christianity that really separated out Satan, you know. So now we have, you know, in the U.S., it's really where it's all happening, right? The Christians versus these Luciferians that control the entertainment world, right? And it's sort of infiltrated into the art world as well. So here you have the opposites right there. So now it's time. Like, let's put the opposites together, and that's the icon of the Age of Aquarius, you see?
Well, accepting and integrating your shadow side, regardless of gender, is what we all have to do in order to attain enlightenment.
Right. And then, so the shadow side of Aquarius, you know, and now with sidereal astrology, of course, follows the precession, and that's what makes a new age. The Aquarius rises at the spring equinox. Then you have the opposite is Leo. So the shadow is all this narcissism, the Leo. So that's where there's all this going on about narcissism. In the U.S., it just seems rampant. And that's because that's the polar opposite of Aquarius. So we have to balance the two, you know. But so the idea of the Aquarian being the empath, and then the empath attracts the narcissist. You know, well,
right.
If you're attracting a narcissist, you need to work more on your inner, narcissist. No, but you know, so yeah. I mean, no, this is the year where it's definitely the change is happening. Finally, I mean, I'm sort of feeling like, God, it's awfully late. You know, I mean, the whole breakdown, the destruction of the planet. You know. Seems really late. I don't know why. I feel like it took an awful long time for And you're right. I mean, women were complicit. That's for sure, you know. But that's what has to change. Without women, it's not.
No, women are yeah. you know, the balancing factor for sure. The you know, all that's positive in women and the divine feminine is
yeah,
necessary to balance out. I mean, Trump, to my mind, is just the personification of what's wrong with male domination. He's almost like a cartoon character. It's
right.
hysterical. So, he's
well, the U.S. needed that, right? I mean, obviously.
Yeah, we created him. We absolutely brought him into being in this way. And I suspect had somebody gotten a look at his tax returns, this would not have happened in this way, because we would have understood, the public would have understood, that his economic empire, his business empire, is based on, you know, a house of cards. But what he did do was took control and presented himself in a new way, in a way that people had not seen. The way he went after Bill Clinton in the debates and used the women, again, used Clinton's accusers. He was absolutely, not necessarily that he was the strategist, but whoever was the strategist, and no doubt nothing was done without his input, he really played the perception role, or it was played in his campaign very well. And it was done with smoke and mirrors. You know, he was able to manipulate the public,
well,
a portion of the public.
I was a reporter in Latin America, so I'm sort of used to that. It's like, you know, that's what I was writing about in Argentina. You know, they need that caudillo, is the word in Spanish, that will, like, you know, bring the country, the nation together. Well, it just didn't happen in America yet. But that's a sign of breakdown, that they need the strong figure. And again, back to astrology, it has Leo rising. So we're dealing with, you know, he has the strength.
Yeah, know? Gemini with Leo rising.
Yeah, well, and he's a Uranus on his sun, which makes them, when they say a Uranus on your sun makes you automatic Aquarian. So I'm not railing, that's why I left the U.S. It's like, I'm not like going on that bandwagon of putting down Trump. I think he's exactly what is needed for the time, you know.
I agree. He's supposed to be motivating us, and he's not, you know, it's not, we are not standing up in the way that we need to be standing up.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But the point is, I mean, he's the breakdown. I mean, he's what's needed to show that everything is broken down. You know, everything's broken down. The whole system in America. So that's, now it's abundantly clear. But they also have somebody to blame. Well, Trump is a symptom. He's not the problem. I mean, the problem existed long before Trump.
Right.
So then,
exactly.
I guess you come full circle. All this breakthroughs in the 60s. Well, what happened? You know, I mean, I know the drugs pretty much took over, and I was warned about that by my father, which is a funny thing. I was going to Mexico, and I go, "Oh, I can't wait to take some mushrooms." And he says, he got very upset with me. He says, "Don't you take drugs? You can do this on your own." He says, "I took everything." You know, the psychiatrist. The psychologists were all experimenting with drugs then. You know, now they're saying, oh, it was all a CIA plot. I don't know, you know. And I just did this piece on Paul is Dead, and these Paul is Dead people saying that he was, that was, you know, that the Beatles were engineered by Tavistock. You know, they go to all these extremes. It's just like, come on. I mean, the CIA was definitely wanted to do experiments with drugs to find out if they could, you know, use that to control. Which, so, as far as the, you know, what was coming out in music, you know, I can't say it was all culturally engineered. I mean, I've been investigating this. So, but something did happen. I mean, because things got very repressed again, you know, after that sort of like wave, you know, there was that Aquarian wave in the 60s. But that's the way change happens, right? It never is going to happen all at once. It happens like in a zigzag, like it happens in a big way and then it's pulled back. So you can like see the waves, you know, it was the 60s and then the 80s was the woman's spirituality movement that came out of the feminist movement. And that's where you had Gambutas talking, you know, I mean, that was the whole new way of thinking about archaeology, about these goddess figurines. So you could suddenly talk about the goddess in the 80s, even though that the art world wants it going for that, you know, like there is like they consider that new age and they didn't want to get involved and blah blah, they didn't want to be considered that. And so, you know, the thing is,
well, we're experiencing similar aspects to the 1960s now. We've been going through, you know, some repeats, and Richard Tarnas in his book Cosmos and Psyche talks extensively about the astrology and repeat patterns. Unfortunately, today we don't have moral leaders like we had in the 60s who inspired people and encouraged them to take action. So instead, we have people posting comments on YouTube or for an article and thinking that's activism. Well, it really isn't.
Well, but that's the point. The CIA Operation Peacock, was it called? I mean, the CIA has made sure that no leaders, new thought leaders, was going to emerge. There, you know, when you live in Berlin, you really like, Berliners understand all this. Americans are like so naive still, I think. And this is where they have to really wake up. You know, like there
well, the education system has been deliberately dumbed down for more than 100 years. So people are being educated to be complacent and go along with
course.
The program.
But also this program of the CIA to like buy out, develop these shell organizations that would buy out any kind of new thinker. I mean, this is what's been going on. Small presses aren't bought to develop them. They're bought to shut down through some shell group by the CIA. So Berlin had an amazing show on this. There's no way it would ever come to America. I forgot what it was called. It was unbelievable. I mean, that there was a man who was a CIA, working for the CIA, who had some organization, you know, I don't remember the name of it. And he developed conferences all over the world because they decided there needed to be, you know, an ideology to combat communism because all the intellectuals were communists, right? So they created neoliberalism. And there was an exhibition about this. That's how they created neoliberalism. They created the stars, you know, and this is like was all planned. So there was a film about it that this man, you know, he created conferences. Well, who's not going to go to conference if they pay your way and pay you to be there and everything? And then as soon as they found out, you know, nobody wanted anything to do with them, you know. It's really quite a story, but, you know, this is like this. Berlin is where like a lot of this is known because that was their story of Berlin, you know, where surveillance is the most surveillance capital of the world. So they,
well,
you know,
just another reason to develop your own inner guidance so that you have the ability to discern between truth and fiction.
Exactly. I mean, that's what it's come down to, right? This last year. What is truth? Well, that's where, but that's going within. That takes some inner exploration, right? And then we're talking back about the Kundalini and like the fear of opening that up, you know, and if you're not well grounded, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. I know that like much more recently, women are having Kundalini openings all everywhere, and it's all a beautiful experience. So that's, I think, what's going on. The vibration has gone high enough that, you know, the collective, it's a collective, it's a quantum leap now, you see.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, those of us on the cutting edge, you know, it was very difficult. You know, I was working with a shaman. We were doing sweat lodges in France, you know. And, I mean, this was like, there were all these kind of shamans running around in Paris that just, it was all talk. The French is so much in the head. So we were like, he wanted me to come over and help him bust these shamans. And then we had this sweat lodge in Brittany and we did some, you know, but it was hard. I mean, you know, it almost killed me. So this was like the idea. I mean, he would explain it like there's a grid around the collective. And of course, all this deep state, you know, works within that, right, to create this grid, support the grid. And it's like busting through the grid. That's really what it felt like in those days, you know. So somehow in the 60s, and that was there was a stellium, you know, a bunch of planets in Aquarius in 1962, right? And there was the Beatles. But that was, you know, that was one of the collective opening. But that's, can you hold on to that? So the same thing with the Kundalini awakening. You know, you have that awakening, or you, even through drugs or whatever, but can you sustain it, you see? So it's the same thing as in the individual as in the culture, that we have these waves, but can it be sustained? Because then, and then the people that come up during those waves, if they're not well grounded, they're not focused or whatever, they don't have funding, which was always my problem, then they disappear. So this is what's going on, you know. Hopefully.
Well, it's an interesting time to be here, and it's up to all of us to share the information that we have, because we are, in fact, on the same path with all the people who've gone before us on this journey, all the people who are currently on this journey, and all the people in the future who will be on this journey. We're all working together in the quantum field, and because of that fact, anything can happen.
Well, that's a great place to end it, right? I mean, that's just what I wanted to say, is that you had to go into the mystery schools, you had to be a novice. Of course, women weren't allowed in, you know, and now you can get all this information freely available on the internet. I'm actually writing now. I'm publishing a Kundalini handbook. I'm calling Stillness.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because it's the idea of, we have to just get still. If we can get still and allow these inner phenomenon to take place, that's the real transformation. It's exactly, in a way, the opposite of what we've been told, especially women, we have to go out there and be active. We got to make things happen. No, we just have to go within. You know, the universe is within. This is what the sages have always told us. But the tools for sustaining that, you know, are freely available. And here I'm putting it out there. You know, this is, I have 6 golden rules that I've been giving, giving in my, you know, when I do astrology readings, that really, if you follow these rules, you know, you can get into the transcendence of it, right? You know,
that's really really valuable information. Lisa, how can people get a hold of you, both for astrology readings and also to find out more about your work?
Just through my email, or through Facebook. I'm online. I'm very easy to find.
We'll have all that information with your bio.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, well, it'll be in the bio, and we could something you write in conjunction with these podcasts, right? I'll give you some links.
Perfect.
I mean, I really love astrology. I stopped doing it for many years. Again, I had to keep that hidden because I didn't want to be known as a fortune teller who writes criticism, you know. Well, I was called that once. And you
Wow.
know, yeah, then I brought astrology into continental philosophy, basically. I'm sure I'm the only person who's ever done a dissertation with astrology charts in it. So that was that allowed me. Now I can go to the academy and say I'm astrologer, you know. Even though I still don't try not to use that word. It still has an association that people recoil. Something about maybe I've had to. That's where you asked me earlier, before we started recording, about the science of magic. I'm calling it science of magic, which is about learning how to attune yourself to these cosmic forces, you know. And of course, astrology, and this is, goes back before the Greeks, you know. I mean, but the Greeks, that was the Greek system, is calling these planets gods. And then, you know, how they interact with each other is the myths. That's what astrology is. It's about the patterns of these interrelationships between the planetary forces. And as long as I'm talking about that, I'll just say that that's the big shift taking place now. Anybody's listening that is following astrology, it was the Pluto-Saturn conjunction on the 10th, right with an eclipse. So this is very rare. Actually, the last time Saturn and Pluto have been conjunct in Capricorn was 15, I forget the year now, but it was when Luther nailed the proclamations to the church door. So that was the whole Protestant Reformation. So this is a huge shift finally, you know, happening that's going to really, I mean, this is the real paradigm shift, as you had said really eloquently. So I'm just giving like sort of an astrological backdrop to that. Why
Well,
this
I'm
is
ready.
so.
I'm sure you are too.
Yeah. And here we're doing our part to have this conversation. I think we brought up some stuff that I've never seen before in any podcast anywhere, you know, about how this feminine energy, the goddess, has been repressed and then appropriated by men and called by many names, anything but the goddess, to establish their genius, you know. And this is, you and I are taking that back, right? Aquarian women taking that back.
It honestly, and I've paid for it throughout my life, but it was never an issue. It was never an issue for me. And I'm not sure, which parent I got that from or where it came from, but and I've taken plenty of slugs from the time I was a really little kid, because I would not accept, being repressed or told no if it didn't make sense. There was just no way on earth. I mean, I went to Catholic grammar school. I got F's in conduct, and
Oh my God.
my seventh grade teacher said to me, "Ferraletto, if you were a boy," meaning he would have gotten physical. And believe me, I wasn't so bad. I just was not interested in any kind of ridiculousness, for lack of a better word. Like, if it didn't make sense, I wasn't going to go along with you. And when he would say this to me, and make me stand in the corner, he'd say, "Ferraletto, if you were a boy," and I'd just look at him and say, "But I'm not." I mean, the logic was, I'm a girl. I'm not a boy.
Maybe at that, I would say at that moment you realize your strength, you know, to
Yeah,
be
but
a
that's what I'm
woman.
saying. At 2 years
Yeah.
old, it was there. I was always this way. So,
I know, but I mean, the boys knew that.
yeah, the
Yeah, the
boys
boys knew.
definitely, everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. And the most important thing is I knew it. So, and I've paid a price for that, but that's okay because it was important for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I have really, well, we talked about how we're opposites because our charts are opposite even though we're Aquarius. Yeah, it wasn't so clear to me. I had too much, there's too much going on, I think, in my environment with my father's work or something, and things weren't so clear. But that's the journey we have to go on, right? Anyway, I'm very grateful to you. Nobody's ever asked me to do a talk on Kundalini before, even though I put out this material for what, how long now? At least 10 years. And, you know.
Well, the connection between Lee and your father is too, it's too big to not focus on, you know, that's amazing.
My father really got written out of history just the way a woman would. Isn't that interesting? It's a Scorpio. It's everything had to be in the dark somehow. So this is a really nice way of, for me, of resurrecting my father, you know, that he really did all this pioneering work and never got any kind of credit for it. And, you know, although, you know, it does come back to me in strange ways. When I got to Berlin, a filmmaker, an East German filmmaker contacted me. He wanted, not video, it had to be film, and, of my father's encounter groups. He said my father's work, because he had this book called Growth Games. That's where he went on all these talk shows with this, promoting this book. Was used with East, with the integration between East and West Germany. Wow, that was a shock to me to find out my father's work was used in integrated, you know, to integrate Germany. So yeah, this is interesting how it comes back. You know, that was a real surprise for me with the Lee connection. So I guess that will keep happening. It makes things interesting. Always kind of mysterious, you know. Life has to have some mystery, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lisa, and enjoy the sun in Aquarius. We have a few more weeks of being in our sun sign, in our element.
Yeah, well, a few weeks for relaxation, and then it goes into Saturn, goes into Aquarius, and then we have to really work to get out there. So thank you for being ahead of this curve. You know, it's really amazing we never met earlier, but I guess that was for a reason. And great, this has been great. So thank you.
Thank you again, and we'll have you back.
Okay, good.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Next time we'll read your chart and find out why you never. That would be interesting. Okay.
Well, what? What did you say?
I said next time I could read your chart on the air. That would be interesting.
Oh.
You can find out. You said you don't know why. Well, astrology supposedly can tell you just about everything, except what sex you are. See? Your chart could be a man's chart. You don't know that when you read a chart. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, okay.
Well, it's just one final thought. It's interesting to me that you brought up Schopenhauer, because I've read all of Schopenhauer, and
oh, God.
When in my 20s, and I lived in Manhattan for 18 years, and I would read Schopenhauer on the number 5 bus, because I lived on the Upper West Side. And I hated the subway, so I would take the bus all the way from Soho, where the number 5 bus began, up to Columbia University or Riverside Drive, or in my case, I lived on Claremont Avenue, which is where Manhattan School of Music is, and at the time. And reading Schopenhauer, I felt like he was sitting in this big armchair, just giving information, imparting wisdom to me, you know, as you'd sit at the feet of a wise grandfather. And reading Nietzsche, he described the exact same experience with Schopenhauer, of having this image of Schopenhauer sitting in a chair, just giving him all this information. So, you know, I do believe that we're all being fed what we need as we need it.
Yeah.
So pay attention.
Well,
pay attention, people.
Yeah, it's very amazing that we're having this talk, and I was doing tracing Schopenhauer up to my father. Now I could trace it with Lee and then you, right? I mean, now I've learned that you're so into Schopenhauer. So, yeah, there's a whole lineage there that's really, it's the idea of the genius, you know, that you have to do it on your own. And that's
only way, in my opinion, that you should do it, because then you're testing the information as it comes in. And, you know, truthfully, that's one of the problems with gurus. You know, they're transmitting their enlightenment to you, but, you know, what is the quality, what is the flavor of their enlightenment? There are all kinds of, you know, gradations of what we're receiving from another. And, you know, that's a whole other topic of discussion for another interview.
Yeah, because but it's hard to stop this conversation because you just keep igniting new thoughts, very Aquarian. But that's the thing. The guru setup is very male. I mean, the woman's idea is about experience, and you said testing it. And so that's the body, right? But this is what's been totally, you know, left out of Western tradition, is the female body, this idea of experience, right? So this is how we got where we are today. And the funny thing about Schopenhauer, I mean, he was born under a full moon. He was very connected to the feminine, you see. And so when he found this Hinduism, you know, it was the feminine experience, really, that he was transmitting. Funny, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very ironic. Anyway, that's for another discussion.
Thank you again. Bye for now.
All right, bye-bye.